This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Jefferson Smith. I'm reminded again of Jacob Riis. When nothing seems to help, I go and look at a stonecutter hammering away at his rock perhaps 100 times without as much as a crack showing in it. Yet at the 101st blow, it will split in two, and I will know it was not that blow that did it, but all that had gone before. I have made the case here, when I have had the honor of sitting in, that the exercise right now, that the political moment is not a momentary one. The exercise right now will require exercise because it will require endurance and stamina, that it is both a sprint and a marathon. Somebody who is working on this, who is hammering away at the rock, who is working both to sprint and a marathon, is going to be our guest in just a moment. I've also made the case when I have had the honor of sitting in that victories are more likely to come at the local level. I have felt this way since 2004. Barack Obama surprised me. When I looked at the array of power that had been built up, it seemed to me that we were 20 to 40 years away from having a sufficiently organized and strong progressive movement in this country. Of course, hard to predict with the current rate and rapidity of change in the social media era and with how demography is changing. But nonetheless, it is clear again that local victories are critically important. Women's suffrage didn't happen because Congress said so. It happened because state by state, we bent the arc of the moral universe towards justice. Nick Abraham is joining us. Right now, I'm not going to steal his thunder. They are working on a state slash local initiative to do something about one of the biggest challenges facing our world and our country. Nick, thanks for joining us. What are you working on?
Hey, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. Here in Washington, we're working on
Washington State.
Out here in the Northwest, we were working on something that's prehistoric. It is going to be the first pollution fee in the country to make it to the ballot, and we hope will be the first carbon price in the entire country to pass by a vote of the people.
So explain, you put a price on carbon. And how much is that price? Give us just the quickest details, because most of the listeners aren't in Washington State, but I want to open up the discussion about how people can act, can you know, sort of live the bumper sticker of thinking big picture and living locally, thinking globally and acting where they are.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what our mentality is trying to do what we can in Washington to reduce pollution. So, our price starts at $15 a ton, and it's only charged to the largest polluters in Washington State. This is folks like the oil industry, utilities that haven't yet switched over to clean energy, because we really feel that they are the ones who have caused the most harm to people, and we think they should be the ones paying the cost.
So my policy nerd question is, how much will it raise gas and energy prices, and how do you respond to the inevitable critique that your opponents will use, which is, oh yeah, you call yourself progressive, but you're going to raise prices on poor people?
Yeah, no, and I love a good wonky question like that. We are charging this to the largest polluters. It's not going to be charged to individuals. We felt really strongly we wanted to structure the price that way. We know that the oil industry is going to try and pass these costs down, but they are not going to be able to. They're going to have to take on a lot of this burden, and we know the only way we're going to be able to put those costs on the folks that are causing the most harm is if we build out alternatives to what the oil industry is trying to do. Right now, they have a complete monopoly on where we get our energy. So if we can build out a lot of these alternatives, which is what this initiative does, we're going to be able to put those costs back on the industries that are causing the most harm and build out cleaner energy, cleaner communities for more people.
And how do you do that? So you impose the price, $15 a ton, I think you said, on the largest polluting industries, for instance, major utilities, to encourage them not to use coal and to use more renewables, and on oil and gas to encourage them to internalize their costs so people use other means potentially. And then what do you spend the money on? It goes directly to renewable energy alternative sources. You send it back in little checks like Alaska does. What do you use the money for?
Right. So, you know, that's what's pretty unique about our approach. You know, the price is one part of it, but the really important piece, the one that we're the most excited about, is where these investments are going. You know, 70% of this is going to create about $1 billion a year, and we're going to put that towards transitioning communities to clean energy. So that, yes, it's going to mean putting money into renewable energy, but it's also going to be things like home retrofits for energy efficiency. It's going to be putting money back into our natural resources, which is such a huge part of our state's economy in the Northwest. And that's going to be stuff like healthier forests, because we know that's such a good way to clean the air and reduce pollution, is investing in those natural systems that are doing it on their own. And we can put a lot of money back into our state and be able to invest in the things we know are making us stronger for the long term.
Who's paying for the ballot initiative?
We have the largest coalition in our state's history. We have folks like the largest labor unions in Washington are all behind us. Of course, environmental groups, but then folks like community of color advocates, health professionals. We have the largest faith groups in Washington who are coming on board with our organization. So we have an incredibly diverse array of organizations that are supporting us. And the funding for this is coming from all sorts of different groups amongst those organizations.
What are your chances? So I'm really glad you spent this time and are talking to us about it, because I do, as I introduce the segment, I do think that the most inspiring activities are those that not only are aiming our pea shooters at the largest elephant, but also accomplishing local objectives and modeling good policy. What are your chances of winning? So you don't have to win at Congress. That gives you a better chance. You decided to go to the ballot in Washington State. Washington State is a purple state leaning blue, or a blue state leaning purple. What are your chances of winning?
Yeah, I think that's a really good description of our politics out here. We feel really good about this. You know, we've seen that large polls in our state show that people care about pollution. They know it's a problem. It's something that they are going to tackle. You know, we've had some good polling. I can't tell you all the details of it yet, but we are well above water, and we feel really strongly that we have a good shot at this year. Unfortunately, the oil industry, we know, is already gearing up against us. They are, all the largest oil industry folks have already pledged money to battle our initiative. Shell Oil, BP, Exxon, all the famous names there have all lined up together around a single pack to come against us. But, we know we have more people on our side always in these battles. So the fact that we have this diversity of organizations that are supporting us, this many organizations that are marching in line, all on the same initiative, all towards the same goal, we know if we all stand together, we can be able to out people.
And I'm from Oregon State, just to the south, for people around the country who, have about as much awareness of the Pacific Northwest as you and I might be able to map every state in the Midwest. Although I'm getting better, in our state, when we try to do a tobacco tax, when we try to do a GMO, not even prohibiting anything, just labeling. Right. The industry forces came in and made those at their time. I think also the GMO was the most expensive ballot initiatives on one side ever, and ended them. What kind of money you think you're up against? What's the most expensive ballot initiative that has happened in Washington? What kind of money you think you can raise? I heard you make the point, well, we might not win in money, but win in people. But talk a little bit about the money before we break.
Yeah, absolutely. So, we are getting funding from a lot of the organizations that have been supporting this that I mentioned before, labor unions, the environmental folks, a lot of community color organizations that are raising in-kind donations, from going out and knocking on doors, supporting us. So, a lot of it is not going to come in dollars and cents. It's going to come in boots on the ground. And that is a value that they just can't quantify. That they will always be able to outraise us. But we really feel strongly that we have, like we said,
oil company executives aren't going to be spending their, Saturday afternoons knocking on doors in King County. Yeah, I hear you.
They don't have a ground game. And we know we can always outmaneuver them in that sense. They're going to be flooding the airwaves. But we feel pretty strong, and we know their game plan. We've seen what they've done in California before. We've seen what they've tried to do in states like Oregon, battling against the great initiative they've passed there. So, we feel pretty strong, and we know what they're going to try and do.
Nick, where can people find out more?
Yeah, if you go to yes, Y-E-S, on 1631, 1631.org, you can find out more about what we're trying to do. And if you're in Washington, be able to get involved. And for folks around the country that want to support something like this, that's the best place to go.
Nick, thanks a lot for what you're doing. It gives a little bit of hope for people who are looking at not only Supreme Court justice they're not rooting for, but things they might want to watch in a good way.
Absolutely.
Appreciate your time.
We appreciate it.
Donald, you have been waiting the most patiently on WCPT, Ain't Afraid of Me, Aurora, Illinois, Supreme Court Justices, speak your piece.
Yes, it's about the Supreme Court Justices that I'm really fed up with, because I've been listening to them for years. I remember what some of the stuff, they're supposed to be working together as a nonpartisan group. They're supposed to be voting on things amongst themselves. This is the way I thought or I understood them correctly, but they don't. They are nothing but politicians in black robes. That is, they always seem to cater. They always seem to be appointed by the party. They actually work for the party that appointed them. It seems to be more and more that way, and it shouldn't be that way. And not only that, there too, this business of having a job till you hit the gravesite is a lot of nonsense. We don't have that. There should be term limits on them and age limits, either 70 years old and 20 years, whichever comes first. And then whenever those two goals are hit, out they go. This bit, because now we get Supreme Court justices that can hold this country hostage by one single party for a generation or more. This has got to stop.
I appreciate the call. It makes me think of a couple things. So I think it was Rick Perry. Was it Rick Perry who proposed that Supreme Court terms go 18 years, so a president would have a more predictable number of vacancies each time? Given lifespans now, Supreme Court justices live longer, and given they're so much more obviously partisan, and there's been the big sort in political parties, so political parties are more obvious now, you make a stronger argument. This is the Tom Hartman Show. I'm Jeff.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Show. Call in number 202-808-9925. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Jefferson Smith. We are talking about the war on democracy. We are talking about, are there limits to and places where a government of greed will not go? It turns out mother's milk is one of the places they will go. In a negative way, surprising even my jaded, jaundiced eye. We are also talking about the Supreme Court, and we are joined by, on the phone, our caller Roxanne from Albuquerque. Albuquerque, Roxanne, speak your piece.
Hi. I'm calling to say that I think that all-out resistance on the Supreme Court nominee, whoever it is really essential. I know it's a long shot. I know that common knowledge is that we won't make it, but I think that makes it just as important. We need to be seen as a party that fights for its principles, and we now have the reputation of being wimps who don't stand up for anything. I don't think that people vote for that kind of party as easily as they'll vote for somebody who's really fighting for their principles. So all-out resistance is our best bet, I think, to get people out to vote for us in November.
All right. I want to agree, and I want to quibble. I might even want to ask a question, which may be more than you bargained for, and you can hang up on me anytime you want. So I want to agree that I think that vigorous advocacy in the face of oppression is the only moral option. The second thing I want to say is, with respect, my quibble, if you will, and I will, is when we say, oh, well, Democrats are seen as wimps. I will say that I think that is a reputation that is spawned by a media that is faux liberal. And by that, I don't mean they're trying to be liberal. I mean, they're described by someone else as such. And it ain't true. And that has been the effete, the effeminate, the elite, the fluffy-hearted, the critique, going back before Reagan, of really since the ascendance of the liberal movement, which was so victorious in so many ways through the civil rights movement, etc., that has infected even viewpoints of people who don't want it to be true. That I do not think there is weakness in nurture. I don't think there is weakness in considering alternative viewpoints. I don't think there's weakness in compromise. I don't see weakness primarily. I do see a fundamental challenge that there is insufficient power in media, in voting blocks, in donors, in a cacophony of virtue and morality and support and trying to resolve our past sins. And I say that myself, having ones I'm deeply ashamed of. And the only thing I can do, the only thing we can do, the only thing our sinful nation can do to address those sins is try to make a better tomorrow. That if we, that the forces for good, if you will, and maybe that puts it too baldly, but the forces for good don't have enough force and need more force. And so I don't put it on Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker to have had that movement been built. Their job is to be U.S. senators. Now, they should be as courageous as they can be. It is also a problem that Democrats, when they run to their base, run away from their money. When Republicans run to their base, they run towards their money. That is a strategic, fundamental defect of money in politics. But that is my mild quibble, Roxanne. But as far as the idea to fight, I agree with you. This is the Tom Hartman Show. We'll be back. Was that Free Speech TV? This is the Tom Hartman Show. That was Free Speech TV. And you're you, and I'm me. I'm Jeff. All right. We've been having a discussion. We've heard a few different people say Democrats need to fight harder. And I agree. But I also think that the critique that Democrats are weak is one that is largely fabricated by opponents, that is leaked into consciousness, not merely, and I would say not primarily because of the accuracy of the claim, but because it's repetition. Because people who wanted to gain majority, supermajority support over white male voters and donors and power wielders made the case, you don't want to be a sissy. It was a misogynist message. It continues to be a misogynist message. And I think that we have to be careful. We have to watch our own language. We have to be careful at how we add to the narratives that plague us. I don't do it perfectly, far from it. But I think we have to be watchful and aware. But somebody who does want to make this case is Jim from Santa Fe. Jim, speak your piece.
Hey, Jeff. Good talking to you, buddy. Enjoy your covering.
Thanks, man.
And listen, all I wanted to do was just make a point, which you just got through kind of covering there, Jeff, was that the Democrats, to me, are not putting the platform of big government, small government. The Republicans run for crying out loud on small government, less government. And all they're doing with this breast milk thing is just tip of the iceberg for me. That's the reason why I'm calling. I can't believe it. I mean, what are we going back to the 1920s? I mean, this is big government to its max. And the Democrats got to get out there. Those Bookers and those Kamala Harris's and all the rest of those guys, Jeff, they need to get out there and start talking. I think our leader in the Senate is a good old boy from New York. But I tell you what, he and Nancy Pelosi, both of those guys aren't sending the right message. And they're the leaders of the Democratic Party. And Obama's got too much class to get involved on this. I wish I could talk to Obama right now. He'd be telling the same thing. You guys got to get out there and start freaking barking.
All right. Sorry, so no.
It was a rant.
It's fair. A person who can get through a week without a rant, I question their sanity. I question their moral connectivity. But I do want to respond. First of all, by agreeing, yeah, get out there. But here's the thing I'm trying to add to the conversation. What I want to add to the conversation is, who's Cory Booker supposed to say this to? Supposed to have more town hall meetings? He's having them. Is he supposed to be going on the Sunday talk shows? I assure you, he is accepting every invitation that he has. Is he supposed to have his own TV show? Maybe that's one thing maybe they should do, is be going straight to the people more with video. But as we think about what's happened, and it even relates to the comment prior, the Democrats need to stand up. They need to be strong. Well, of course they do. That is not wrong. But that is not, I would say, the primary challenge. The primary challenge is the movement has to be built. And usually the politician is not the builder of a movement. Usually they are something that comes from the movement, or they're somebody who co-opts the movement, or somebody the movement can live with and therefore support or oppose. That the politician's job is different from the movement builders. I wish it weren't. I wish there were more movement builder politicians. But the incentive structure isn't built to be that, nor, by the way, is the time schedule. That it wasn't Newt Gingrich that merely that built their movement. Rush Limbaugh did a whole bunch of it. Rush Limbaugh helped make AM radio a force. And by making AM radio a force, and by creating a constituency that could be persuaded, and then galvanizing them, then Fox News realized, hey, wait a minute. Barry Diller, who I don't think was much of an ideologue, went to Rupert Murdoch and said, hey, here's a market. You can go get them. And they created Fox News, and that was a market that had been built largely by Limbaugh and AM radio right-wing talk hosts. And that built the movement. And that meant that someone like Mitch McConnell doesn't have to be a movement builder. He is no great speaker. He is not the person that people are saying, Hosanna, Hosanna. Rough consensus, we shouldn't call it. The leading contender in the discussion today has been Kavanaugh, who seems like he might be able to get Susan Collins' vote. Seems like he is on the Federalist Society list. And he has demonstrated some hesitance at holding presidents to account. And Donald Trump could be very attracted to that idea. But to me, the deeper point at this moment in history is not just who's the person who's going to get this lifetime appointment of a bachelorette rose, but rather, what do we need to learn? How do we need to organize our movement so that we can win the long discussion? That Supreme Court justice nominations do not happen on the day of the appointment. That nomination, the event, the news is not at 9 o'clock Eastern tonight. The news has been over 50 years. And the context is the thing that we have to help people understand better. And that it is a reaction. It is, I don't want to glorify it by calling a backlash. It is a lashing, I think, ever since Brown versus Board of Education, when it became clear that courts could be a tool for justice, that they could be a tool to fight oppression, that those who did not want to be fettered by such things built organizations, built infrastructure and apparatus in order to tear down a pro-democracy force. And that is what is at stake. And so I want to think, yes, about what are the ins and outs of the given Supreme Court appointment, but more importantly, what are the ins and outs of how we build a pro-democracy movement? Right now, we are talking to a bunch of people, including, and I really appreciate your calls, because a lot of people have been calling in about that very thing, including Rick, Free Speech TV from Irwin, Texas. You want to make a case about Democrats. Speak your piece.
Yeah, it's Irwin, Tennessee, bro.
Oh, I'm so. What did I call it? Texas?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it started with a T, and
yeah,
I figured.
Anyhow, I moved here in 1991 when Clinton just got elected, and I worked a graveyard shift, and I'd get off in the morning, and I'd watch C-SPAN, and the jobs were happening. I mean, you could get a job through one of these temporary agencies, and you could quit and get another one the next day. And on C-SPAN, it was all Republican, Republican, Republican. Then Bush come in, jobs dried up, and C-SPAN kind of evened out. You get Democrats and Republicans. And now there's more jobs. They're not worth a rat's, you know what, but
tail.
A lot of people are working. And, you know, this theory that Democrats are weak, they're not weak. They're just not organized. They just don't have a frame of reference to just drive stuff like the Republicans do. I mean, they got the Heritage Foundation. They got, you know, all this BS, all these think tanks and all this crap. You know, and they drive this stuff constantly, every day, just drilling it into everybody's mind.
Yep.
That's what the difference is right
yep.
there, bro.
I could use words to agree, but instead I'll just say thank you. John, calling from Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
First, I wish to thank you for using on the air the word pedantic.
I don't know whether to say I'm sorry or you're welcome.
Oh, and pointing out champing versus chomping and stomping versus champing. Maybe there is hope. Perhaps another show you might look into, healthy versus healthful.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
That's the reason I called.
That's fine. I appreciate it. And I will say, I mostly appreciate your call because it's, you know, it makes me feel good and it's mildly amusing. But I think that language matters. And maybe it's only a nod to my now past grandmother, who if I would come in and say, hey, us guys are going to go out and, you know, go swimming. And she would say, us does nothing. We do things. And, you know, I'm not a grammar watcher. I'm not a grammarian, but occasionally I will say this at least. I like to learn stuff when I listen. And in hearing the calls we get from listeners, we have smart listeners. And I think they want to learn stuff too. And if I know 17 things, which I don't know a million, but I know 17, then I should maybe use, you know, if I'm helped this 17 times, each time I should teach at least one. All right. I want to hear from Denise from Chicago.
Yeah, hi. This is the second time I'm calling in while you've been there, and it's really great. But I want to comment on, because the subject is so cool, and I kind of like the last caller because he was just so straight and said it. But I think there's a miss. When we start talking about, and let me just take one step back, I do agree with you. The Supreme Court decision has been going on for 30, 40 years. But the piece that I get frustrated with is when I listen to Schumer or Kamala Harris, I feel like they're making statements that want to be written down in a history book instead of being strong and to the point.
Interesting.
And hard-hitting. You know, it's all this flowery stuff. Let us, you know, be thankful and strong and blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, they're lies.
It's
get to the point.
It's an interesting comment, and I agree with you. I think that there is, okay, one of the senators from my state, who I know and am friendly with, is, I watch him at town halls and I'm amazed because he, in answer to any question, can give an answer that I am sure would focus group and poll very well. And
yep.
And his comments are really ably measured. And I can understand the impulse. It's like what you're trained to do as an elected official, in part because the good word you say might motivate less energy than the bad slip up you make, which can be captured on video and delivered to swing voters and your political opponents in a myriad of forms. And until Donald Trump, people thought that would end their political careers. But I do think the election of Donald Trump demonstrates that there are some people longing for, some people just longing for greed and racism, but I think there's some people longing for someone who sounds like people that they know talk. And people...
Can I make two other
Please,
points?
Go ahead.
Okay, so if you listen to Steve Schmidt and Nicole Wallace, I really wasn't that big of a fan of theirs before, but I got to tell you, they know how to articulate and just say it.
Yeah.
And I really feel like I'm becoming this Democrat-Republican new party because they come out and just say it. And my last point is Bernie. Bernie resonated with people. He was like an FDR. I mean, FDR, let me warn you, right? Those are hard-hitting words. And that's Bernie came out as for the world. And that's what the Republicans do. We ask for, oh, can we have this? Oh, we can have this piece. Then we can have this piece. No, the Republicans said, get rid of the ACA. And Bernie said, hey, health care for everybody.
Yeah.
And Hillary said, you know, well, how are we going to pay for it? It doesn't matter, really. It's about just that messaging is so powerful. And then everything works, you know, the Republicans will always get what they want. But do you see where I'm going?
I do. And I want to agree, and I want to add something, that there is a dynamic that I think encourages this, and it's not, and I don't think it's moral or rhetorical weakness. And one of those dynamics is the thing I said very, very briefly before the last break, which is when Democrats run to their base, they are running away from their money. Not running away from all their money, not running away from most of their small donors, some of their institutional support, but when they have to go and collect federal maximum checks at Martha's Vineyard or Wall Street house parties, which is the way you get elected a governor, U.S. Senate, and certainly the presidency, when you do your Silicon Valley meeting, that what mostly you hear is please be measured. What they don't like about Donald Trump is that he's always shrill or he's nasty in how he talks. I'm fine with oligarchy, but I wish he would just not curse. And so that is part of the challenge. So if you are in Cory Booker's shoes, you are trying to figure out how do you communicate both to the worker and to the to the working mom and to the person in that boardroom. And how you do that is tricky. Bill Clinton and Barack Obama did that better than most people in history, but it is tricky. And that's why I put most of my focus, and I encourage most of us to put our focus, less on critiquing the communication of a given politician and more on how do we build a movement so that if they say the right thing, they are rewarded for it. If they say the wrong thing, then it's wrong based on principle, not on verbiage, and we reward the kind of behavior and build the kind of movement that we want, if I'm making any sense.
Yeah, and here's the last thing I'll say, and I know there's other callers, but what's the most memorable thing Barack Obama said that comes into my mind that sticks? And it's in that great speech that he went, come on, man. And I gotta tell you, that to me said everything. It was like, come on, man. Get what? Really? and I've got advice for Cory Booker. He could say, you know what? I'm not going to cuss. Remind people, I'm not going to cuss like Trump. Why would I use those words?
Right.
Let me use some other words that make sense. So
thank you, Denise.
Thank you, sense for today.
Cheers. Tony from Cleveland Christians.
Yes, I'm calling to let the Republicans know that they are not the Bible readers. They say they are. They don't even know their own Bible. For in Deuteronomy 10:17, it says, well, circumcise therefore the foreskin of your heart and be no more stiff-necked. For the Lord your God is a mighty God, and he regardeth not persons, nor taketh reward. He doth execute the judgment of the fatherless and the widows, and loveth the stranger, and giveth him food and raiment. Love ye therefore the stranger, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt.
Thank you.
So, therefore, they're not even reading the Bible following what their God said. So how can we expect them to even listen to us? They're godless, really, and they're just using the Bible.
Amen, Tony, and love thy neighbor. Jane from Lockford, Illinois.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was listening to your station this morning, and I was listening to callers in talking about the law against breastfeeding.
Not a law against, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. That was the problem, because I've been talking. How did it come up?
Yeah, I should explain. I explained at the beginning of the show, but then I've been referring to it without explaining. So there was Ecuador was putting forward a proposal that had unanimous international support to encourage mother's milk, to encourage breastfeeding, as its health benefits. And the Trump administration blocked that resolution. And they blocked that resolution, at the behest of manufacturers of baby formula. It was a political, it was executing a political bribe. That's the background.
Thank you. I don't get to listen to the beginnings of the shows, and so I miss things like that. Okay, so it is not a law, and it was generated by what you just explained.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. That clears up a lot.
Well, and thanks for your question. Probably some other people had it. Appreciate your call. Faye, you want to make the case to shorten the term for the Supreme Court. What's your case?
Yes, thank you. My question is that since the Supreme Court have been sabotaged by the Republican Party, is there any possibility that we as the Democratic Party can reduce the terms of the Supreme Court from life to maybe 5 years? Is that a possibility?
I wouldn't say it's not a possibility. It is very, very hard. A thing that is because the Supreme Court is laid out in the Constitution. But something that is not laid in the laid out in the Constitution is not only does the Supreme Court not have to be, justice have to be a lawyer, but there don't have to be nine. There could be 10, 11, or 12. FDR attempted this when the Lochner Court was blocking New Deal reforms during the New Deal. And it took a while to be able to get a Supreme Court that wouldn't block him. And he tried to expand the Supreme Court, and it was called court packing. My argument is the court has now been packed, and it's been packed by the Koch brothers, and it's been packed by the Federal Society, and it's been packed by Mitch McConnell, and now it's been packed by Donald Trump. And there could be a discussion about expanding the court. A discussion to shorten terms could also happen, but it is trickier. We're going to be back in just a moment. This is the Tom Hartman Show. I'm Jefferson Smith. Show goes fast. We're almost done. We got a few other callers. We're going to try to get to you. We very much appreciate you. We're back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
This is the Tom Hartman Show. I'm Jefferson Smith. We're back in the Tom Hartman Show. Thanks for watching and listening on Free Speech TV. Opened the show this morning, my time, with the question, how far would a government of greed go? It's a question I want to pick up on another day when we aren't also facing the urgent question, the interesting question of who the next Supreme Court justice nominee will be, and we're supposed to find out tonight. Patricia has a question and maybe a comment on that very subject. Patricia, are you there from Sarasota, Florida?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Yes, I am. The question that I saw was, how far will Trump go?
Yeah.
And what I would like to say, that Trump will go as far as the citizens, the people that live in this country, will allow him to go. This is beyond the political party system. Republicans, Democrats, independents are broken. We need to repair. We need to re-educate ourselves and educate ourselves about what this country is about, what the Constitution states. There are people in this country I have spoken to, okay, that don't even know how our government works.
Yep, civic education in schools, as well as movement building, brick by brick by brick, stone cutting by hammering away at the rock every day. John from Bellevue, Electoral College.
Yes, sir. Jefferson, glad you're there. I can't figure anybody better than Tom to sit there than you.
Thank you. Man, that's really kind of you. Appreciate it.
We got to get rid of the Electoral College, for one thing. We've got to go to paper ballots. After the Detroit, Michigan voting fraud, 80,000 voters registered for all the lower positions and everything, and none of them choices were made on the machines that they'd used. I use paper ballots. I live in this country on a small township office, and I always use paper ballots.
Yeah.
And I think that
go ahead.
I'd like to say one more thing.
Please.
President Obama could have been a little stiffer with Mitch McConnell about that during his term about a placement of a
justice. It's interesting. I very often think that people's greatest strengths are often connected to their greatest weaknesses. Barack Obama is a measured leader. He's a measured leader that combines that with the ability to ignite flames within the soul. That combination of traits, usually which is a trade-off, the ability both to be one of extreme self-discipline and one who can deliver electricity, that's a rare combination. Barack Obama is, in my view, a great president. Not a good president, a great president. I think I view him as my president. I don't know that I will ever in my lifetime have a president who I respect more. That said, I do think, and I think partly because he was reacting to a racist world and figuring out how to operate and be a leader in a racist world, that he, in his tone, in his tenor, in his manner, in many of his decisions, he had the tendency and desire to be a uniter. The thing that George Bush said he would do, Barack Obama, I think, had the real instinct that he wanted to do that. And I'll give data for that. When he appointed justices, he affirmatively said he didn't want Thurgood Marshall's and Justice Brennan's. He didn't want far lefties. He didn't want to do what the right wing was doing. He wanted people who were just going to be, you know, center lefties, honorable justices. And I do think that that has its costs. I say that, by the way, still complimenting the president. This is the Tom Hartmann Show. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. I'm Jefferson Smith. Thanks for doing it. Thanks for watching. Thanks for helping. Thanks for supporting the sponsors that make it possible. Thank you to the staff who put it on. Thank you to Tom, who's away today. And thanks for inviting me. All right, Zach, Free Speech TV, speak your piece.
Good morning, Jeff.
What's up, man?
It's too bad we don't have 500, let me say it again, 500 radio stations to tell people, which is us, not the left, but this vast truth center, to stop voting for the inheriting class, because they're going to cheat you every time. The same terms mean different things to progressives and conservatives. When progressives use the term the American people, for instance, they're referring to we, the people, the working class person, who just wants to play by the rules and get a fair shake. I call them the fair shakers. When conservatives refer to the American people, they're referring to a tiny base of business and advertising executives. They got their start with daddy's grubstake, and I call them the gougers. They keep propelling nepotism and partisan fights at the expense of democracy. And just know, both sides don't do it. It's the inheriting class doing it.
And amen. And it underscores the thing I've been trying to say here, which is not to see the debate as one that's right versus left, but see as democracy versus property. I like your phrase, the inheriting class. And by the way, there ain't no such thing as a death tax. Almighty God takes every penny away from all of us at death. There is inheritance tax, there is an estate tax, and there's a rich kid's tax, but there's no such thing as a death tax. Michael, listening on Progress Radio, what do you have to say?
Oh, hello. Moments ago, you brought up about love thy neighbor or love your neighbor.
Yeah.
And why you liberals, Democrats, do not love we conservatives?
I will tell you, it is that I think I can genuinely say that I do. And even at this moment, Michael, I love you. And I can also say that, and I say this as someone whose grandfather, who's almost my entire father's side and mother's side of the family, absent my mother and father, are die-in-the-wool conservatives. Ronald Reagan was on my grandfather's mantle, not Ronald Reagan as the human being, but a picture of him signed.
Yeah.
And was my dear friend. But what I hate is oppression. I don't think all conservatives are oppressive, but I do think there is a line of thinking that is wielding power that harms other people, and that we have to fight against that thing. But I do think we have to separate the people from the problem. We have to be soft on the people and hard on the problem. And the problem is anti-democracy. The problem is pro-property, anti-humanity. The problem is oppression. We got to be hard on those problems. We got to love people as best we can. Where am I stupid?
No, I think you're correct in that. I just, you know, when I listen to the radio station throughout the day, because I listen to both Patriot and your station and MSNBC and Fox, I just feel that there's a lot of on your dial there, a lot of your hosts.
Which station is that?
The Stephanie Miller show in the morning.
Oh yeah, okay, yeah, that's
very anti-Trump, anti-conservative, anti-Republican. I just think it's a crazy. I listen because I laugh at what they say.
Yeah.
About
I will say, there is anger, and I think there is legitimate anger. And I'm not gonna spend most of my time critiquing someone whose policies I agree with most of the time. But I will say, speaking for me, that I hope to be as strident as I can about values and about objectives, and I also hope to be as human as I can when interacting with human beings.
Okay, that's fine. That's a good answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you. I want to say thanks to everybody. You are priceless. Definition of priceless: worth a lot, not for sale.
You've been listening to Tom Hartmann. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartmann.com.